The aftermath of nonviolence is the creation of the beloved community. The aftermath of nonviolence is redemption. The aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation. The aftermath of violence, however, is bitterness. And this is the thing I'm concerned about. Let us fight passionately and unrelentingly for the goal of justice and freedom. But let's be sure that our hands are clean in the struggle. Let us never fight with falsehood and violence and hate and malice, but always fight with love, so that when the day comes that the walls of segregation have completely crumbled in Montgomery, that we will be able to live with people as our brothers and sisters.
I always like to begin the show with those words from Martin Luther King Jr., what he talked about, the beloved community, and how nonviolence is the one that is, well, violence can get us perhaps some immediate results. It does not last. And enforcing and pressure is always constantly required. But the fruits of nonviolence can actually ultimately work for a beloved community in which people who had been in opposition can ultimately become working together for justice and peace. Good morning. My name is John Shuck. This is The Beloved Community every second Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. You can find my website at progressivespirit.net. Got a new one coming up, johnshuck.com, but we've just got a few things on there trying to get that built together. Anyway, I'm all kind of all over the web. You can find me at different places. Today, the show is titled Awakening to Justice. I have two guests. The first half hour, Portland resident Ned Roche, who has written a chapter for a new book called, the book is called Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Studies of Personal Transformation. Ned has written a chapter for that book. We're going to talk about, he's going to read from that chapter, and we're going to talk about that. Then in the second half hour, my guest will be Mustafa Akwan, who is the founder and executive director for Shia Rights Watch. I met him when I was in Washington, D.C. just this past weekend. I had the opportunity to speak for the Universal Muslim Association of America conference, the film that I made going to Iraq for Arba'in. We made a 29-minute documentary, and so I had a chance to show that, and it was graciously received by folks, and I had a chance to meet Mustafa there, and I thought, well, he'd be a great guest to talk about Shia rights issues throughout the world. Ned Roche is in the studio with me. Ned was on the show about 4 years ago, I think it was here.
That's right.
All right. Glad. Welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
All right. Now, Ned, you've written a chapter for this book, Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation. Your chapter is entitled Palestine and My Journey of Self-Discovery. I'm going to ask you to read a selection from it in just a second. But first of all, how did this book come to be?
Well, there is an activist in the Washington, D.C. area named Carolyn Karcher, who, like many of us American Jews, grew up a Zionist. For most of us, Zionism was in the air that we breathed, and it just was part and parcel, we thought, of being Jewish, that if you were Jewish, you celebrated the reclaiming of, as we saw it, the reclaiming of the land of historic Palestine after 2,000 years of, quote, dispossession and centuries and centuries of persecution culminating in the Holocaust. And therefore, this was almost like another chapter to the Bible. It was this triumphant return. So Carolyn was aware of the fact that so many of us now, the numbers are growing by the year, went through a transformation and found that in rediscovering Judaism through our activist work for Palestinian rights, we found new meaning, and we became different people. And for many of us, it became the journey of our lives, where we learned a lot about politics, we learned a lot about the importance of struggling with and for indigenous peoples, and we learned a lot about the aftermath of colonialism and the havoc that it has wreaked in the world.
So Zionism, as you see, is kind of a chapter, a wing, something of colonialism itself?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Zionism came about in the late 1800s. There was In the late 1800s, there was an issue that happened in France that was pretty interesting. It's called the Dreyfus Affair. And Dreyfus was a Jewish-French officer in the army who was accused of treason. And on very flimsy evidence, he was convicted. It came out 4 years later, the real person that committed the crime confessed. But Dreyfus, in the meantime, had spent 4 years in solitary confinement. And this was proof to Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of Zionism, that Jews would never be safe, would never find freedom and justice in Europe, and that the return to Zion after 2,000 years was really the noble cause of his day.
Okay. So we're going to talk about that because really, you know, you think of it, Judaism has been thousands of years, and then yet Zionism is so really recent. And yet it has become so dominant that almost that taking over the very identity of Jews in some respects.
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind that there have always been Jews that opposed Zionism.
And still do.
And still do. That's what this book is all about.
Right. And even Orthodox Jews as well have from a long time of all along.
There are some very, very religious Orthodox Jews that do believe that only God could bring about the return of Jews to the Holy Land, and therefore they don't believe in the State of Israel because that was brought about by humans, and that's not in their understanding of how religion and the teachings of the Torah should unfold. But there have always been Jews that have opposed Zionism and believe that Jews ought to build the world of justice and ethics and Judaism wherever they find themselves. And this return to Zionism, this return to, you know, what became Israel, that was inhabited by another people now, was problematic, to say the least.
I'm speaking with Ned Roche, if you just tuned in. The book is new. It's called Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation. And Ned, a Portland resident, has written a chapter in that called Palestine and My Journey of Self-Discovery. Ned, why don't you read for us a selection from that chapter?
Sure. Thank you. Indian writer Arundhati Roy explained, quote, "The trouble is that once you see it, you can't unsee it. And once you've seen it, keeping quiet, saying nothing, becomes as political an act as speaking out." End quote. For a brief but remarkable week and a half, I had the amazing privilege of being part of a health delegation to Gaza in November 2014. To be there just 2 months after Israel's murderous 2014 war on the people of Gaza was to catch a glimpse, through the painful stories I heard and the overwhelming destruction I witnessed, of the grotesque horror of those 51 devastating days. The bombed-out structures were everywhere, the grief pervasive, the trauma intense. I saw haunting skeletons of homes, people living in bombed-out buildings and mosques, hospitals and factories reduced to rubble. In heavily destroyed civilian neighborhoods, Palestinian people were living in makeshift structures of cardboard and blankets, surrounded by utter devastation. The impact of witnessing families squatting next to what was everything they had owned and what in a matter of seconds had been absolutely wiped out took my breath away, as did a large busted-up slab of concrete with names spray-painted on it, of family members buried under the mounds of debris. A woman sitting on the rubble staring vacantly off into the distance, and a wedding party celebrating amid ravaged buildings. Imad, a nurse who works full-time and had not been paid for over a year, invited me to meet his family. When asked how they survive with no income, Imad shrugged his shoulders and pensively posed the question, "What can we do?" While walking through an area that was heavily bombed by the Israelis, I was approached by a man who offered me a large manuscript covered with the dust of blown-up neighborhoods. He motioned for me to follow him across the street to a huge mound of debris. As we climbed up the pile, avoiding broken glass, twisted rebar, and busted-up concrete, he pulled out his phone and showed me a picture of quite an attractive and well-maintained home. His home. He explained that we were standing on that home and that absolutely everything had been destroyed except for that manuscript. His doctoral dissertation, a literary critique of the words of Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. This professor, who had lost it all, was insisting that I take at least part of what remained of a life. Possibly this professor was saying that in spite of all the destruction the Israelis could unleash at will, there is one thing they can never destroy. Ideas. Not only about Pound and Eliot, but also about the restoration of justice to a people who have suffered unimaginable brutality, dispossession, and ethnic cleansing. It's difficult to make sense of how the occupation and siege of Gaza, which is slowly but very steadily crushing the life of over 2 million people, can be happening with the world doing so little to stop it. Imad's question, "What can we do?" echoes always in my head. Some of what I can do is clear, a stronger commitment to, as Arundhati Roy says, speaking out, and to doing my part to grow the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, BDS, a principled, nonviolent response led by the Palestinian people. My commitment is further to assert the Palestinian struggle more broadly and more intersectionally. In Gaza, I left behind friends and a piece of my heart, a heart that was broken many years earlier by the conflict between what I had been raised to believe about Israel and what I had come to learn was its darker reality. Years ago, I sincerely believed that I was being more than open-minded when I tried to hold to the conviction that there were two legitimate and distinctly different narratives, one Jewish and one Palestinian, two fundamentally irreconcilable claims to the same piece of land, and that was why the conflict was so unresolvable. But what was really unresolvable was the battle that thunderously raged in my head and even more vigorously in my heart. I'd become a progressive on every issue, but when it came to Palestine, I was extraordinarily torn up. Named after a Holocaust victim, how could I contribute to undermining the Jewish struggle to reconstruct a post-Holocaust decimated people and the state of Israel that had so recently come into existence? Well, with time, my dual narrative world began to significantly fray at the edges and eventually completely unravel. Probably the crushing blow came when a Palestinian friend asked why so many Jews have such a hard time recognizing the urgency of incorporating the Palestinian experience into the Jewish understanding of history. He challenged me to see not two separate conflicting narratives, but one history of what actually happened. That challenge took me on one of the deepest and most rewarding journeys of my life. The struggle to fundamentally reconcile my politics around Israel-Palestine with my core values and ultimately understanding in the essence of my being that my true liberation as a Jewish person is now forever intrinsically bound up with the authentic liberation of the Palestinian people. Zionism imprisons not only Palestinian bodies, but Jewish minds as well. The breakthrough for me was the ultimate realization that in supporting the Palestinian struggle, I was upholding Judaism's highest values and reclaiming them for myself in a profoundly meaningful way. For years, I despaired that the intersection of the ethical teachings of Judaism with the political ideology of Zionism might be a windfall for Zionism, but would likely lead to the spiritual death of the faith. I'm now more convinced than ever that the essential work of reclaiming Judaism from Zionism through proudly standing as allies with the Palestinian struggle has the potential to unleash a deeply reflective, profoundly ethical, and long overdue reimagining of what it means to be Jewish. In solidarity, in struggle, with humility and hope, we turn the page to our next chapter.
Ned Roche reading from Palestine and My Journey of Self-Discovery. His chapter, part of his chapter in the book Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation, Ned Roche. And you'll be, you are actually going around and talking about this chapter in various groups. I know you're coming to my congregation, Southminster, Sunday, August 4th, 9 a.m. And be joined by the Islamic Center of Portland, residents from there too as well. I think it'll be an interesting discussion. But you've gone other places and talked about this chapter as well.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting is that we're seeing a profound shift. I think that Americans are looking for deeper understanding of this so-called conflict that has been described by so many so often as too complicated to understand and, you know, just leave it up to us, the Israelis, to figure it out. We get it, you don't. And I think that there is a yearning for people to have honest discussion around this issue. And so that's what this book provides an opportunity for me to do. And personally, I feel that one of the strong points of the book is that it's a collection of 40 stories, stories of transformation. So it's not a political science lecture. It's not a history lesson, mm-hmm. although all of that is incorporated in the stories. But it's stories that people can connect with and understand. And from that, perhaps challenge some of the assumptions that are out there in the broader society.
That isn't easy to do. It isn't easy to be that self-reflective. You're going against the grain. I was thinking of Martin Luther King Jr., nearly his last speech at Riverside Church. I just happened to read it the other day, and talking about how the quest for a person to go against all of the cultural, all of the political, all of the narratives that are there takes a big heart. Or it takes an experience like you had of recognizing who am I, what am I to do, and you found that when you've discovered the human beings in Gaza.
Yeah, you know, I think that the very very few times that I've been called an anti-Semite or a self-hating Jew, they pale in comparison to how good, how grounding it feels to stand up for justice. Like mm-hmm. you were mentioning Dr. King. I don't put myself in his category, but that notion that you're on the right side of history is very important to getting up in the morning and to carrying on in life. And I think that for those of us in this struggle for justice for the Palestinian people, or for any cause for that matter, that ability to identify with people that are struggling and to find our place within that struggle adds tremendous meaning to one's life.
I know it was about a few years, back about the same time I think that you went to Gaza, it was 2014, Rabbi Brent Rosen was writing about it, and he talked about his own transformation that he had had as a rabbi, and he talked about how the Star of David, you know, in the synagogue, a central place in and of itself, the Star of David, a Jewish symbol in a sense, but really the flag for the nation state of Israel and all the confusion that had. It was really a personal struggle for him and as many to discover, gosh, what's this about and what is being done in our name?
Well, yeah, I think that what's pretty fascinating to understand is that 90% of the synagogues in this country have the Israeli flag right next to the Ark, right next to the Torah. So there's an American flag and an Israeli flag. And I think that combination of the ethics and the principles and the teachings of Judaism merged with a political ideology of Zionism has been a disaster. And that's what is happening right now within the Jewish community, and I think this book is a reflection of it. There's a rebirth, and there's a reexamination of, should we as Jews embrace an ideology that is all about one people, the Jewish people, having right to the land that another people, the indigenous people of Palestine, had lived on for centuries? And the answer that we all have concluded is absolutely not. And in being part of that struggle to rewrite history and to reconnect with the ethical teachings, we find deep meaning.
You wrote, as I was reading it, you said, why is the world doing so little to stop it? And can you talk a little bit about that? Do you have an answer to that question?
Well, I think that Western powers have seen Israel as a bulwark against the Middle East, Islamic movements within the Middle East that people in the West are afraid of, don't understand. And, you know, the originators of Zionism saw this as an opportunity. Actually, Theodor Herzl talked about how we could ally with the Western powers and they would give us cover. And this, you know, to the current day is something that you hear and see all the time in Israel. Ehud Barak, a former prime minister not that many years ago, talked about Israel as the villa in the jungle. So perpetuating this idea that somehow Israel is civilized in a very uncivilized region. And that, I think, has been something that Israel has played very effectively, a card it's played very effectively.
Yeah, certainly. We talk about Zionism for, and Judaism, but we could also talk about Zionism and Christianity. Christian Zionism is often even larger, and that has been a powerful effect of the narrative that Israel is the only democracy there, or it's God chosen, and all of that kind of thing that plays into a lot of certainly the media understanding as well of what's happening there.
I think that's very important what you're raising. Christian Zionism has actually been around longer than Jewish Zionism. Mm-hmm. And there is a belief, as you know, that when the Jews are finally ingathered into historic Palestine, Jews will then be given the choice to either accept Jesus or go to hell. And at that point, when Jews make that decision, there is this belief among very fundamentalist, very right-wing Christians that Jesus will return and life will be good. And so Israel plays into that. And There's another component that happened early on, and that was that because of anti-Semitism in Europe that so many political leaders had, actually Lord Balfour, who is the writer, the originator of the Balfour Declaration, he was a livid anti-Semite, and his belief was that we could create a homeland in Palestine, which had just been taken over by the British from the Turks, when the Turkish Empire fell in the First World War, and we could create in Palestine a Jewish homeland that would keep Jews from emigrating from Europe to England, because it was about 100 years ago that the Balfour Declaration, of course, came into being, and that was a time when there was massive emigration out of Russia, which became the Soviet Union, because of, you know, tremendous pogroms and horrific anti-Semitism that took place there. So the Balfour Declaration, which became, in a sense, the founding document of Zionism, was really put forth by an anti-Semite in England.
You know, you bring up the topic. We just got about 5 minutes left, so I want to get to the things that are most important. One of the things you brought up was the word anti-Semitism, and certainly that's anti-Semitism is behavior, actions, words that are racist against the Jewish people via religion or via ethnicity. But also, anti-Semitism is used, would you say, to stop criticism of Israel or to stop, for example, even things like the, as you had mentioned, the BDS movement. Can you talk a little bit about how anti-Semitism and that dual function?
Yeah, that's also a really important point. One of the few arguments that Zionists have left is that particular argument, that if you're critical of the state of Israel, if you're critical of Zionism, if you're critical of what Israel's doing, you're probably doing it because you're an anti-Semite, because no longer can they argue morality, no longer can they argue that the history of what has unfolded really looks favorably upon the Zionist movement. Zionism really is a colonial movement, and as virtually every other colonial movement has come to naught or has been transformed, we certainly have work in this country to do around that regard, but in many former colonies throughout Asia, the Middle East, Africa, independence has taken place. So Zionism is a movement that is now defended most often by the criticism of people that attack it, that those people attacking it and standing up for justice are really anti-Semitic. So the question becomes, in fact, are you anti-Semitic? I would say that if you're criticizing Israel because you dislike Jewish people, yes, you're anti-Semitic. Mm-hmm. If you're criticizing Israel because you have a profound belief that all people are entitled to equality, justice, and freedom, then your criticism of Israel is legitimate, well-founded, and the farthest thing from anti-Semitism. In fact, I would say it's called having a conscience.
Yes, and I think it's so critical for Jews like yourself to be able to come and talk about it this way, because I think it's sometimes it's very difficult for people to engage it that way. Young people, young Jews in America, are they more critical of Israel than their parents?
Yeah, you know, there's a fascinating thing, and that is that in Israel, the younger Jewish generation is more right-wing and more conservative than their parents. That might be the only country in the world where that's true. I don't know. But here in this country, young Jewish people are leading the way. And the attachment that young Jewish people have to Israel is far less than their parents' generation. And that's a good trend.
Ned Roche has my guest. His chapter in the book Reclaiming Judaism from Zionism, Stories of Personal Transformation, is his own story, Palestine and My Journey of Self-Discovery. We just got about 1 minute left, Ned. A final word or a final thought about how to pick up the book or anything you'd like to add?
Well, for me, the interesting thing about this is that it's a journey that is really the essence, I think, of what the Torah and what Judaism and its teachings are all about. It's the journey of our lives. It's the journey we Jews need to be in struggle and in solidarity with. And through it, we find deeper meaning.
Great. And Ned Roschel, of course, will be happy to speak at any organization. I know he'll be at Southminster Presbyterian in Beaverton Sunday, August 4th at 9 a.m. Ned, thank you for your work, for this book, for your work for justice, for reclaiming Judaism, for your own struggle of the heart. I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, John.
We're going to be back with the second half of the show. I have Mustafa Akhwan, who is the founder and executive director of Shia Rights Watch, and he is going to be speaking with me from Washington, D.C., and we'll catch him up after this short break. You are listening to The Beloved Community.
I always placed my pride in only Hussein, whilst others placed their pride in trees they would trace. There are only two things that make men better. Neither of them are origin or birthplace. The first is a man's piety and fear of God, courageous, selfless, living a life of grace. The second is when their ears hear Hussein's name, an ocean of tears begin to stroll down their face. That's all that matters. Not skin and not culture. Not hometown. Not home country. Not color. Not race. No racist stood on Hussein's side on Ashura. And no racist shall ever feel his embrace. Feel his
embrace. Oh Hussein, I see you embrace your lover, O Hussein. Regardless his race or color, O Hussein. Why you no stranger, a stranger. O Hussein, I see you embrace your lover, O Hussein. Regardless his race or color, O Hussein. Why you no stranger, a stranger.
I see the day of Ashura.
Welcome back to The Beloved Community. My name is John Shunk. Every second Friday from 9 to 10 a.m., stories of spirituality, social justice. We just had a conversation with Ned Roche about reclaiming Judaism from Zionism. My guest on the phone with me from Washington, D.C., is Mustafa Akhwan. He's the founder and executive director of Shia Rights Watch. His peace advocacy efforts span from west to east as he facilitates nonviolence on the ground in war-ridden nations such as Iraq. He founded the Shia Rights Watch, which focuses on the humanitarian rights of Shia Muslims in 2011. SRW, that is Shia Rights Watch, obtained active consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council and now holds special consultative status with the United Nations in Geneva and New York. With a network of over 600 people, Shia Rights Watch plays a critical role in improving the quality of life for all minority populations around the world. Various human rights and peacekeeping organizations have recognized Mr. Akhwan's human rights advocacy, including Free Muslim, Center for De-Radicalization and Extremism Prevention, Amnesty International, Human Rights Education Association, the United States Institute of Peace, Adams Center for Defending Rights and Beliefs, and Center for Strategic Studies in Iraq. Mustafa holds a Bachelor of Computer Science and a Bachelor of Business Administration, and Master of Science in Conflict Analysis and Resolution from George Mason University, focusing on dynamics of violence. He also has led facilitation, mediation, and peace-building programs in places such as Iraq and Afghanistan. I met him when I was at the Universal Muslim Association of America conference just this last weekend in Washington, D.C., and I thought he'd be a great guest to have on the program. Welcome, Mustafa, to the Beloved Community.
Hi, John. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm so glad you're here. So tell me a little bit about the Shia Rights Watch exist. How did it come to be? Why did you decide to put this organization together back in 2011?
Well, the violence against the Shia Muslims were broadly in different countries, and unfortunately, the media and the organization would not put the effort to know about the Shia Muslims and their suffering in different countries. So the organization was created to do a research and advocacy in that regard, to promote the peace, at the same time give a clear example and the cases that no one else know about.
One of the words that I see throughout the website that is ShiaRightsWatch.org is anti-Shiism. Can you describe that?
Well, broadly in different countries, especially in the Western country, you see the term anti-Semitism that is going on. And everyone who talk about the suffering of the Jewish, they are highlighted. But for the Shia, we didn't have this terminology. So we came up with the terminology of anti-Shiism to expose the violence that is happening against the Shias. At the same time, encourage other people to look at to the broader picture and monitor what is going on against the Shias in different countries. This is not only the violence toward the gun conflict, but there is a lot of issues that is happening from hate speech that is going on, from arresting, torturing, and kidnapping the Shias in different countries. As different countries, I'm talking about from the Middle East to the West to the Madagascar to the Africa. So there is a lot of violence is happening against the Shia, and using this terminology would be a very clear message for those who don't understand exactly what is going on against the Shia.
Well, Shia Islam is a minority within Islam, but it's a minority who speak out for justice, in my discovery. Oppressive governments see Shias as a threat in some respects. Is that correct?
Well, the thing is, they put a lot of politic interest on when it comes to the suffering of the Shias. Yes, a lot of people say, you know, highlight the Shias and connect them to the Iranian government, which you cannot limit the faith to one country.
Mm-hmm.
And because there is a lot of lack of knowledge and the effort that the other countries are putting to just show the Shias as the violent people is not true. And I can strongly say that we didn't even have one Shia who was in Guantanamo. We didn't have one Shia spiritual leader or a scholar to promote the hate or violence against any religion.
Yes. So well, let's go country by country, if you will. For example, on the webpage, I noticed for June 2019, Bahrain, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia were listed with anti-Shia events. Can you talk about some of those in each country?
Well, the systematic torture, killing, and abuse against the Shia in different countries it varies. For example, in Pakistan, you see a lot of attack on very educated scholars. You see the attack against the Shia lawyers. The people who can influence the peace and influence the society, they are targeted. In Saudi Arabia, there is a little bit of the politics involved with that. When the Saudi Arabia would want to put the pressure on Iranian government, for some reason, Shia are the one who are getting slaughtered or killed. Past 2 months, we had 37 Shia was executed, and another case we had 12 Shia were executed, which didn't have anything against the government. And those countries, Iraq is the same thing. We see that with the movement of the ISIS, and at the same time, right now, what is going on in the change of the government and the cities over there, the Shia are the only ones who are getting targeted. And because there is no one talk about them, because there is no one defend them, they become an easy target for them.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. 37 people were executed, and some of those were teenagers, as yeah. I recall. For the crime was putting something on social media, wasn't it?
Yes. So the Saudi government, one of the issues that they do, if they arrest a underage kid, like a 10, 12 years old, who either protest against the injustice in the Eastern province, they were arrested, and they are arrested. Many of them are in prison right now. And they hold them until they become 17, 18, and charge them and execute them, which happened in a couple of cases over there. They put the case of the anti-terrorism or security issue, which none of those was convicted on that charge. And because there is no legal court to work on those cases, the Saudi have a lot of power to do what they want to do.
I had on my program about a year ago Muhammad al-Nimr, who was the son of Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr, who was also executed by the Saudi government. And his execution was because he spoke out for human rights issues. Is that are you familiar with that case?
Yes. Sheikh Nimr was one of the very well-known scholars, and he was known in Saudi Arabia to be peaceful. He was known to not only talk about the Shias and suffering of the other people of faith and non-faith in the country, and asking the government to give a little bit more freedom and allow them to participate in the government with the law of the country. What any of those scholars are asking is just to have equal citizenship and have a voice in the country rather than being just marginalized in those countries. And he was unfortunately executed, and the majority of the countries did ignore that.
I'm speaking with Mustafa Akhwand. He's the founder and executive director of Shia Rights Watch, headquartered in Washington, D.C. When I was last year, I had a chance to go to Arba'in. I want to say two things about that. One is that there's hardly anything known much about Arba'in in the media, and I wonder if that's a part of perhaps a product of anti-Shiism. I'm saying that, but I don't know what you might think about that. And the other thing is that while I was there, Nigeria, I believe, had really gunned down some pilgrims who are going, you're getting ready to go to Arba'in. Nigeria is really a case of oppression, isn't it?
Yes, Nigeria is one of the countries that the Boko Haram and the government of Nigeria are kind of working hand in hand. And in any cases, it's very well known that the Boko Haram kidnapped the Christian girls and forced them to become extremism. The same thing is happening, that they are putting pressure with the Bible, Boko Haram, to the government to marginalize the Shias. And we had the killing of the wife and the son of Sheikh Zakzaki, which is the very well-known scholar there. And he's been under arrest for since then.
So tell me a little bit more about his story. He's just in the news now.
The same thing is that the scholar is asking for the equality in the country, and working against extremism that is become a path for those who are trying to crack down the government or having better power in the country. And for him, it was very important to talk about those injustices, talk about the extremism, and say that the Shia are not extremists. They are not promoting the violence, and they are just asking for the equality. And Nigeria is one of those countries that extremism have more power than any other people of faith. Christian are marginalized, Shia are marginalized, and the government is not, because there is a corrupted government, they are not putting any effort to stop those violence.
What would you say is one of the biggest challenges that you have in talking about Shia rights in the United States? And I'm going to say a challenge. You may say if it's the biggest or not, but one of the challenges, I think, is that many people do not in America who are non-Muslim have a hard time differentiating between different Islamic groups, between Shia. They lump them all together. Do you find that to be a problem? I guess you could kind of identify that as anti-Shiism, couldn't you?
We can. At the same time, we can't. The issue is, in especially in the United States, because the media is just covering what they want and not letting the people to look at the facts. And we are binded with the media rather than using our knowledge and researching. And the term that the media is using a lot is that, Muslims are coming here to implement their Sharia law, which is not true, definitely on the Shia part of the Muslim world. Sharia law is the law that is abided by Muslims. It doesn't have nothing to do against other religion and faith. The media is not covering that. At the same time, it is in a burden on our shoulders to introduce our religion. You know, you went to Albania, you saw the situation over there, you saw the peaceful people. Between 15 million to 23 million people were there. There was no violence, there was no attack, it was the peaceful people just promoting their religion. In the United States, there is a lot of lack of knowledge. That is one of the most important things that is happening. Yes, they're combining the religion and the politics, which is, it should not be. We cannot just talk, when we talk about the Shia, marginalize them, but when the attack or the abuse and discrimination happen with the other people, we just call it people. When it comes to the Shia Muslims, you hear that a lot, that they say in Shia militia, but when it comes to the other discrimination, the faith is not mentioned at all. This is one of the big issues that is happening in the United States.
And of course, a lot of it has to do with of propaganda for those who want to go to war with Iran, lumping a lot of things together as well, would you say?
Definitely. They're mixing those together, even though, you know, war never was the answer for anything. We cannot just go in different countries and create a war without having the knowledge. We had the same issue when we went to Iraq. Even though majority of the Shia in Iraq were helping the United States to crack down the dictatorship of Saddam, but at the end, Shia were the one who were marginalized in the country. And right now we see, when it comes to the case of Iraq, we talk about the Christianity and the Yazidis more than we talk about the Shia. Even though that the Shia were the number one who were kidnapped and killed, one example of it in Iraq is the Camp Spiker, and I'm sure most of your listeners, they don't know what is a Camp Spiker, and I encourage them to just go look and check Camp Spiker and the massacre of Camp Spiker, which between the Iraqi records say 1,700, but the Shia Rights Watch records come to 3,000 people were slaughtered in one day.
Mm. Slaughtered by who?
By the ISIS and the ISIS supporter.
And it's really the Shia really led the campaign against ISIS in Iraq. I think many people don't know that.
It's very important also to know that if Ayatollah Sistani would not issue a fatwa to defend Iraq as a general, not the people of, not only Shias, to go and defend the country, defend the people of the country. If you talk to the Yazidis, if you talk to the Christians on the ground in Iraq, they tell you that the only one who went and defended the Iraqis in Iraq were the Shia, who were armed by the government and defended and went against the ISIS. And if we see right now ISIS was defeated in Iraq, is only because of the fatwa Ayatollah Sistani and the defending of the Shias of the other people.
Yeah, and on the walk to Arba'in between Najaf and Karbala, on every pillar, every 50 meters is a pillar, 1,400 of these pillars, and there's a poster of a martyr, a young man in that case who gave his life for defending the shrines, defending the country. Al-Sistani's fatwa was a unifying one. It wasn't. It was for people. In addition to Shias, also participated in that. What did he say? He mentioned that Sunnis are not our brothers. We are Sunni, or something to that effect, to recognize the unity itself.
Yes, Ayatollah Sistani fatwa was saying that they are not our brother. They are us.
They are us.
We have
yes.
To be unified. Yes. Be unified. And right now, the militia who were defending the Iraq against the ISIS were not only the Shia, there were Sunnis, there were Christians, there were Yazidis, and every time I go to Iraq for work, I'm surprised to see a lot of those people of different faiths, for example, Christians, who are joined that militia to defend their territories, and Yazidis at the same time. Outside of the country, no one highlighted those, and no one mentioned that they were multi-religion effort to defeat ISIS, not only the Shia who were there. And it is very important to highlight that it was the unified effort between the Shias, Christian, Yazidis, and Sunnis to defeat ISIS.
Yeah, I just don't think in general people know that Shia Islam is really based on of course, the sacrifice of Imam Hussein, who was stood for justice, a justice and peace against tyrants. I mean, that's been its DNA, in a sense, since the beginning, that Shia Islam really has a principle of justice and peace for everyone, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. Imam Hussein wasn't sacrificed only for the Shias. It was sacrificed for the humanity, to show that the human being, they have to coexist and work together and live together. During that time, we had a Shia, Sunnis, Christian were living in those countries. And no one was saying anything. No one was going. None of those religions were fighting each other because of their faith. Yes, it was some economical or political issue, but it wasn't the faith war that is right now is going on in those countries.
Now, I'm speaking with Mustafa Akhwand, founder and executive director of Shia Rights Watch. This is the beloved community. Tell me about your work in Iraq and Afghanistan in regards to peace building.
Our work is a lot of research and advocacy. And the majority of the work right now we are doing in Iraq post-ISIS, I can say, is that there is a lot of mediation that we have to do, a lot of trauma healing that we have to do. We have a lot of psychologists, we have a lot of doctors, lawyers who are working in different territories from the south to the north. And that's not only limited by the Shia. There is other organizations, Christian organizations that we work with to help those families who lost their loved one due to the attack of ISIS. And a lot of female women are they are shocked. They need a lot of trauma healing. They need a lot of mediation between their families, because Iraq is the tribal country, and you have a lot of tribes, and you have to be able to work with those tribes and tribe leaders to help those families. There is a lot of families that need the help. So our aim and our work is over there to gather those families, listen to their stories, and see what are the ways that we can work and help them to come back to the society, come back to what they were doing before. Obviously, we cannot bring back their loved one, but we can help them to ease the process of living in their society due to a lot of issues that was happening. There was ISIS, unfortunately, raping a lot of women in the country. They were selling the women in Iraq to the other countries and in Iraq at the same time. To be able to highlight those issues is very important for us.
Now, you talked about, I'm looking at your webpage. The webpage is called Shia Rights Watch. The URL is Shia, S-H-I-A, rightswatch.org. And one of the headings here is called Calling for Immediate Intervention in Saudi Arabia. What would you like Americans to do in regards to this?
Well, I understand that the Saudi Arabia is a very good ally of United States. We don't want to intervene with that. Obviously, us as the U.S., we have a lot of allies. But we should not just only work on their benefit. The concept of the United States, the ideology of the United States, the constitution of the United States is showing us that we are the democratic country. We are helping and promoting the peace in the world. The coexistence of the different faith and religion and non-faith is very clear here. Why we are not promoting that when it comes to the Saudi Arabia? Saudi Arabia is just a ruling country by only one family, and we don't see the coexistence that we see in the United States. So when we are doing a deal with the Saudi Arabia, it's very important for us to understand that in order to that deal happen, there is some of the human rights issue, woman rights issue, children rights issue that we have to highlight at the same time. So as a U.S. citizen, I should be able to go to my congressman and talk to them and highlight those issues and demand those subjects to be in part of the deal that we are making, especially with the Saudi Arabia.
There are about, what would you say, 700,000 Shia or so in the United States? Is that close?
Yes, roughly, yes.
Tell me about some of the challenges and struggles for Shia Muslims in the United States itself.
The challenges, I don't know if I can call it challenge, but the issue is that whenever we go and talk to the different people, one of the most important things that when as soon as we say we are Shia, and that's due to the propaganda that is happening, they say, oh, you're Iranian. Mm-hmm. Which is wrong. Any of those citizens of those countries, they are abided by the law of those countries. If the person is Iraqi, and always, if you talk to the Shias, they will tell you this. When you ask them, who are you? They say, I'm American Iraqi, an American Saudi. The American become first for us because this is our country. The politics played a lot of role, media played a lot of role too. Misdirected people of how to deal with the Shias in those countries, and the United States especially. So it's important for us to highlight those and the other people to read and work on those concepts that is going on.
Do you find persecution against Shias in the United States itself?
No, we didn't have any cases, neither by the government or by the groups. You see one or two small cases that due to the uneducated people, Muslim people, not the United States. No, I did not find any single case that is happening in the United States due to being a Shia, no.
So in addition to Bahrain, Nigeria, and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, are there any other countries in which Shia rights are being violated?
Oh, I can name a lot of them. Malaysia, Indonesia, for example, Malaysia, Shia publication is banned. Indonesia, there is a lot of Shia were dislocated from their houses, and some of them were living in the different areas due to the violence and the pressure that the government is doing in Indonesia. Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, Madagascar, Nigeria, Sudan, and list go on and on.
Now, are the people who do this persecuting, what do they have in common? Are they from Are they mostly fundamental Wahhabist groups or Salafist groups or what?
The fundamental ideology that they have is come to the Wahhabism and the Salafism. Yes, definitely. We do not have this issue with the Shia Sunnis that everyone try to say that this is a sectarian issue. No, it's the extremism ideology that is putting a lot of pressure on that. And those countries that I mentioned, if you look at the history of the country, you see the footsteps of Saudi Arabia, footsteps of Wahhabism that is promoting and funding the extremist scholars on those countries to become extremism, at the same time highlight those issues and issue a propaganda against the Shia.
We just have about 30 seconds left. Mustafa Akhwan, my guest, founder and executive director of Shia Rights Watch out of Washington, D.C. I'll give you a final word. Anything that you would like any listener to know?
Well, when we go to the Holocaust Museum, we see that the very well-known quote of Martin Niemöller regarding that I did not speak up and there was no one to speak. I'm just making it brief. And when it comes to me, there was no one to speak. I encourage your listener to do their study, look at the facts, and see what is going on. And obviously, in the regard of the Shia, I can say that we are the only one who have the largest database of the violence against the Shia. They can go to our website, they can sign up to get the update of what is going on and do their studies rather than looking at and listening to the media.
All right. That is definitely good advice. Look at the evidence, look at the studies, rather than just a look at the media. Mustafa Akhwan, thank you so much for being with me today on The Beloved Community. All the best to you.
Thank you very much, John.
You can catch The Beloved Community every second Friday from 9 to 10 a.m. And my name is John Shuck. Be well.